Well, it's 5:15, Gene Shepherd time. I got a request recently along with a pledge. And I figure if somebody will pledge, we'll play their request, which is hear an episode about the Indiana Dunes that he had heard. Well, I knew I had just heard one on that subject, although this one's a little earlier than the broadcast he recalls. Although, as I mentioned earlier, Shepard often repeated his stock stories, so... This episode comes to us from June of 1961. I don't have more of a date than that, just sometime in June of 1961. And it concerns another oft-told theme on the Shepherd Show, the smell of homes. And stuck in a parachute jump and the Indiana Dunes. So let's get to it. Gene Shepherd from 1961. Rare stuff here on Mass Backwards, WBAI, New York.
Standing there by the kitchen table, see, and I've been working on a salami sandwich for maybe 15 minutes when I get an idea. I look over at my mother, who is leaning over the sink wearing her rump-sprung orange chenille bathrobe, working that Brillo pad back and forth like the experienced hand she was. Occasionally, you could hear the sound of the sink. And that was it. This went on, maybe it was silence, and the silence that one lives in, of course, we all live in a certain kind of frame. Your frame is very, very much different from the frame of the guy who lives in the next apartment. In fact, if you walk into an apartment and you are attuned to these frames, you walk into a house, there is even a kind of aroma that exists in a person's home that is different from the aroma that exists in yours. You go into someone's home, and there is a smell. You just know it's them. It's their house. It smells the way their houses always smell, their apartments, no matter where they move. They move four blocks away, and they set in and put up the things and put the rugs down and the flower pots on the windowsills, and somehow, magically, almost instantaneously, it smells just like the other place they lived in. You know, it just happened to me not more than a month or two ago. I'm very, very attuned to this. I don't know why. I don't know whether other people are as attuned to smells in people's houses. Maybe, I don't know. I never hear it talked about. But This friend of mine has this apartment, and it has a certain kind of smell. It's all just a kind of an identifying aroma. Now, you know what I'm talking about. You know this is true. The houses are clean, everything else, and they don't get the wrong idea. It's just, it is a certain kind of smell. Well, moved into a new apartment. And I went to this apartment, and by George, I get to this, it hasn't been in that apartment 12 hours. I'm thinking that on the way up, you know, up the elevator there, I'm thinking, I wonder, I'm just going to make a test here, see whether or not there's a... I walk, open the door, there it is. I'm home. It's uncanny. So I'm standing there, and I'm knocking down that salami. Of course, I'd like to point out what these smells are composed of. They're composed of millions of things, you see. Very, very individual things. Like, for example, to show you how the difference in the smell. Say, for example, apartment A is composed of salami eaters. Compartment B is composed of salami eaters. But compartment A likes hard salami. Compartment B likes soft salami. Already you got two aromas right there. I mean, just like that. One crowd wears tennis shoes. The other crowd has fielder's mitts. Alrighty, you got two different... See, and it's the way they mix. Now, it is rare that a fielder glove crew mixes well. I mean, usually this is a hard salami group. Now, the smells are... And the smell of the leather and the smell of the hard salami and the smell of the goldfish bowl. Now, you see, some have goldfish, others don't. So each, it's composed, you see, each has such an individual aroma because the overall aroma is what we're speaking of. It's composed of a million little parts, like one of these sweaters, you know, where the sweaters are made up of thousands of little threads of different colors, and they're never really quite the same. What was that stuff they used to call it? Waste. Guys used to wipe off cylinder heads with it. It's absorbed grease. Yeah, what do they call it? Waste. Cotton waste, that's all. Now, cotton waste is composed of waste cotton that comes from the mills. Well, it has all kinds of colors and patterns and everything else, and you never know what kind of waste you're going to get. There might be waste that's predominantly blue, and there's a waste that's predominantly green or predominantly yellow or white or any other color you can imagine. But they're never really ever the same because of the mixture. It's a kind of a strange pastiche. And so that's the way with the smells in the houses. And you know, you never can smell your own house. Are you aware of that? You really can't. You can only smell everybody else's house. Now, the only time you can smell your own house is when it doesn't smell like it normally smells. You know, cabbage. What's a cabbage? Well, that's not normal, you see. So you're aware of that. But during the normal living in your house, you really are not aware of the smell in your house. For example, I have no idea how any of the houses I have lived in, how they smelled. I'm sure that you don't have any idea how. Have you ever thought about that? Interestingly enough, some of the smells in the houses that you go to are vaguely unpleasant. Others are very pleasant. And it really is no reflection on the people involved. And this, of course, this is what I think is a reflection of whether or not you have the kind of senses that are really sensitive to the things around you. I think that we have senses that hardly any of us have ever really tapped, and I'm not speaking of the metaphysical idea either. I'm just talking about physical senses. Hardly anybody even knows how things feel, for example. I mean, really how they feel, you know? You take a hold of a book and you feel it. You just move your hands back and forth across there and you can feel that. You can feel that grain in the cover, and you move it over the... Yes, feel those pages there, and you feel it. Feeling things is a good sensation, really, you know? There, look at that sugar. My George, look at that feel. You spend all of your life just feeling things. Sometimes you get shot in the head if you do it too often. But, you can really, you know? Of course, it depends on discretion. That's all. We assume you're a discreet individual. And George. But I'm standing there by the... kitchen. I know I'm beginning to wonder what kind of a smell did our house have. I can't think of it now. I know that there was one kid, interestingly enough, there was one kid I remember whose house I hated to go to when I was about 8 or 9 years old because it had an unpleasant aroma about it, an unpleasant smell. And they were very, very, very clean people, you know. I mean, there's nothing like that. Very clean. But the mixture of all the things together in that house, the fielder's mitts and the flexible flyers and the rugs and the dust and the bricks and the wall, everything, the mixture came out bad. I don't know what it was. And it was a vaguely, just a faintly dead smell, I can recall. Just faintly dead. As though something had died there centuries ago. And it was a kind of... I didn't even know what a crypt was then. But I did sense that this was not pleasant. And somehow, it was a thing to be run away from. And so, as a kid, I didn't want to go there, and I'll never forget the awful thing that happened one time as a result of that. I mean, I shouldn't tell you this, but it was an awful situation that arose once. And it was a very embarrassing thing. I was at the house there, and my mother says, "Why don't you go over and play with so-and-so?" And I said, I don't want to go over there. She says, "Well, now look, I've got to do this. I don't want you around the house. It is raining out. Why don't you let me call his mother? You can go over and play with him down in their basement. I want to get rid of you because I've got this stuff to do, and I can't have you around the house." And she was saying this with another neighbor there. Well, I'm just a kid. By the way, this is one of the family legends. You know how families all have a legend? Various things that happen. You know these family legends, these stories of things that happened the time somebody went to the World's Fair and did this. Like we had an uncle who went to the famous uncle who went to Riverview Park one time. Riverview Park is in Chicago. Went to Riverview Park. The third day, he became very famous briefly in the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Herald Examiner for this. He went to Riverview Park, and Riverview Park has a... It's just like Coney Island is what Riverview is, actually, in Chicago. And they had, among other things, a big ride that was one of these parachute rides, you know, where they drop you on a parachute. And it was the first one in America that was like that. It was a big deal. Oh, fantastic thing. Well, he went to Riverview Park. They pulled him to the top of the thing. He's all up there by himself, doing solo. And by the way, there were assembled aunts, cousins, everyone. I was not at present at this affair. This is only family legend. You don't have to be present, you know, at the Fox and the Grapes affair to know about it. I mean, you know what the Fox and the Grapes were, Aesop. I mean, you know, this is a legend. You don't have to be there. You know what the story is. You know what the story is, of course, of Cinderella. You didn't have to be there. So I knew what happened. It was just famous in our family. There were cousins and everybody there. And he wanted to go on the parachute ride. Everyone said, no, they wouldn't get me up there with a 10-foot pole. Kid, 10-foot pole, getting my family up on the ride there. I wouldn't go up there with a 10-foot pole. They couldn't pay me to get on that ride, they're all saying. And his wife, who was a very Gladys, someday ask me about this, Uncle. I'll tell you about this one. He was very rarely seen, but, and this might give you a reason why he never came around. Gladys was a loudmouth, and Gladys said, "Look, why do you have to insist on holding all of us up? You're holding all of us up. Now, you know the kids are hungry. Why don't you wait and go on that ride this afternoon?" He says, "Well, we're right here. I might as well go on the ride. Look how quick. They go up and they come down. That's all. All I want to do is go on the ride." This is a famous story. So Gladys, the loudmouth, says, "Okay, we'll wait." And all the kids are standing around, all the assembled aunts and a couple of uncles who felt rotten, you know, the beer and everything. They were feeling crummy. And so he goes on the ride. Up he goes. And this thing is wild. I don't know whether you've ever ridden on the thing, but you're really up in the air there, you know. You're really up. So they hoist him to the top of the thing. Well, I've ridden on this thing a couple of times, and I'll tell you briefly what it does. You're sitting on what is like a swing. It's actually like a swing in the park, you know. It's really not a chair or a seat or anything. It's just like a board across there with a little thing in the back so that you don't fall over backwards. That's about all. Your feet hang out. That's all. Just hang down there. And there's a little safety belt, and you hang on to the sides. Just big, heavy iron things. You hang on the side. Up you go. And as soon as you hit the top, it has a trigger, a release. And it releases with a jerk. Gets up there, and it goes... And then you drop for about 6 feet. Just absolutely drop. Free fall. And then the parachute catches it. It's got a big hole at the top to let the air out. And it comes down guided by about six different... long metal rods so that you don't go flying out over the lake or anything like that, you know. I mean, not that you wouldn't want to. That would be the greatest thing that could happen, but they never let any real fun happen in this world. I would tell you about the time we got into this. I'll tell you sometime about a parachute. That's a wild experience. But One time I'm in an airplane, and I just have to briefly interpose this. You get this wild sensation sometimes that you're reliving your life. You really do, but you never get it when you think you're going to die. It just never works that way. I'm sitting in this airplane. This was during the war. And something went wrong. All kinds of confusion. And now, when you got on these airplanes, they would just give you this parachute automatically. You'd wear the parachute. It's just like your canteen. You never think about it. And you put the thing on and snap it. And all of a sudden, through the intercom, the guy says, "Prepare to abandon ship." And I'm sitting on this parachute, "Prepare to abandon ship." He says, "Prepare to abandon ship. We're having trouble in number two engine on the starboard side." And I look out and it's going, and smoke is popping up. "Oh, what do I, where's the life saver? Where do I hold on?" And everybody is doing it. You know, they get up and they stand up there like that. And they're pulling the straps and all that. Boy, all of a sudden I'm in a cold sweat. You know, it's like this crazy ride. You know, it's no fun now. And I look down and there's nothing but water and a few little things down there. We're 8 miles up in the air and all that, and the clouds, and it's raining. And the guy says, "Prepare to abandon ship. We're having trouble with engine number two on the starboard side. We are expecting fire momentarily. You will proceed to evacuate the ship upon the countdown, which will be given to you by the crew chief. We want you to follow rotation strictly as to rank. We want you to stay as closely together as you can. Gentlemen, good luck." You don't want to hear the rest of the story. It didn't wind up or end up anything nearly as good as if it had been Van Johnson. I could tell you it was a fiasco from the very beginning, right away. First of all, the guy started to complain. This you never hear. "What do you mean? You're not going to get me to jump out, Jack. You can't ride and drive this rotten thing. You shouldn't be up there in front. It's what they made you a captain for, wise guy." And they're all panicking. The whole army fell apart. Jack should know about this. I mean, the whole chain of command. And the next thing I know, the guy is on the intercom. He's apologizing to us. "So, well, I'm sorry. It's getting on fire out there. It's not me that's doing it. And I'm going to stay with it. I'm sitting right here, Dad." And the guys are sitting. One guy starts to eat a candy bar, and we're sitting. You don't want to hear the rest of this. Luckily, the fire went out. I'll tell you, it was a very embarrassing moment when 20 minutes later we landed at this field and all of us got out. And this guy got out of the front who had been hollering in the intercom that we're about to abandon ship. Everyone looked at him very, you know, this terrible. "What were you trying to get us to do? What were you panicking about there?" Oh, speaking of panics, this is WORAM and FM New York. And we will be here until midnight. Oh, boy. You want to hear about my uncle on the parachute? Well, I'll tell you what happened. Remember, Aunt Gladys had said, "You are going to hold us up. Why don't you just do it after we eat? The kids are crying. It's time to eat." And he says, "No, I want to do it now." Man has to take a stand somewhere. So up he goes. And when you get to the top of this thing, it goes, it makes a sort of, and then it drops. Well, everybody stands there, you see, and there are two parachutes that go up simultaneously. These things work in tandem, like, you see. One is going up and the other one's coming down. So up it goes. By the way, this is Uncle Bob. You never heard me mention him. I'll tell you about him. He was from Algonquin, Illinois. That's why I never mentioned him. He was from the country. That's another world, the country. So up goes, he was always in the country. So yeah, he had a summer cottage, and I'll tell you why he stayed away from us. Any relative who has a summer cottage is dead. All the other relatives are like locusts, believe me. Because what they used to do about every 3 months during the summer, the whole family, Uncle Charles would be on the phone, he's calling everybody, "We're all going to go out and surprise Bob." Yeah, he was never surprised. He was expecting at any moment. You know, it's like death. You're never really surprised when it comes. You secretly suspect it's going to happen anytime. Well, anyway, Bob goes up to the top of this thing. It's family legend. Might as well tell you. It's in the book. You know, we have a book. So it gets to the top. And up like that, it starts to go down. Stuck. Well, Gladys started to holler. "Come on down, will you? The kids are hungry." Well, there's poor old Bob up there, 490 feet in the air. And, you know, you can hear sounds very clearly when you're high up like that. And I'll tell you, you know, you get up to the top of the Empire State Building, you can hear people arguing down on 34th Street, you know. You can. And so there was Gladys hollering, "Come on down, will ya?" Well, poor old Bob starts to argue. It was the greatest long-distance argument that was ever held in Chicago. He says, shut up, I can't get down. What do you want me to do, jump? She said, well, you wanted to get up there, you idiot. Well, they start. See, this is the way they acted at home. This was another thing. This is probably why they lived in the country. Had a lot of trouble with leases and everything, so they lived like this at home. And nobody really thought much about it in the family, but it was wild on a Saturday afternoon at Riverview Park to be witness to a gigantic family argument. It was a fantastic family argument. All the families walking around, they're out of their minds, you know. They want to get out. They want to burrow into the concrete, swim across a river or something, pretend like they're a caterpillar or anything, you know. And Gladys really figured she had this guy pinned this time. Look at him. Anyone can see what a fool. Look at that clown. He's hanging up there in the air there. Come on down. Well, the next thing we knew, the fire department came. The police came, helicopters came, everything. And Bob is up there. Gladys never stopped for a minute. They're trying to fish him down with a net, you know, and they're poking at him with sticks. And it got into the paper, and you know, interestingly enough, it said, here was the picture. This was the wildest picture I ever saw in my life. It was in the Chicago Herald American. It was taken from the ground. You could see the parachute ride way up there, and you could see Bob hanging up there, just a parachute up there. And then they had an inset. It said, grieving wife, shown on ground. And her face was all contorted, but they didn't write what she said. You idiot! For God's sake, get down! And that's all. And a grieving wife. Oh, let me tell you. That poor clown, he never outlived. As far as I know, they're still yelling about that in Algonquin, Illinois. They're still alive. They're still screaming about that very thing. 3.5 hours later, they got him down. The kids are crying. They've been eating the little stuff you can buy out on the street, you know, in the Riverview Park, little cotton candy, and they're sick, and they're hollering, and they're taking. And what made Gladys mad was they were taking pictures of this fool. Yes, and they were, you know, they were asking him, is he all right? And they were feeling him all over, and they were giving him drinks. All the guys at Riverview were very worried they were going to get sued, you know. So they're running him around, and they're giving him brandy and artificial respiration or perspiration or something. They're pumping his arms. Oh, boy. Let me tell you, riding home in the Buick was pure hell that night. Oh, have you ever sat in the back seat of a car when a family argument's going on? And it just, it's gone higher and higher and higher and higher. It gets higher. Speaking of family, we must have something here. We've got plenty of family arguments for you here.
Here's the basic news from General Tire. It's the new Jet Air by General Tire. It's the best tire by far for your kind of car. You'll enjoy smoother riding wherever you are. Get twin tank drop with new Jet Air.
Man, they're like from in front.
Ooh. I wish we could cut that guy out that comes on at the end of that thing. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, we have with us tonight Alba, instant, non-fat, dry milk. And if you are watching the calories, hey, has it ever occurred to you that, have you ever wondered how much all of the people in the United States weigh altogether? I mean, really, that's how much people lard there is in the good old United States. That's very interesting because we are a very overweight nation, you know. We live pretty high off the hog. And I just wonder how much lard there is that is being held up by the North American continent. I mean, just in the total, it would be an interesting figure to know. I really would like to know that. And if you're watching your weight, we would like to suggest that you try Alba Instant Non-Fat Dry Milk. And then you see just a little bit. And have you ever worried where the fat goes when people lose weight? You know, we have it on good authority that, according to the great physicists of all time, that you cannot ever destroy matter. You can only change its form, you know. You're aware of that. Where does the lard go when you lose weight? I mean, now, let's say if Americans next year lose 1.5 billion pounds, where does it go? Do they ship it to Russia? Or do they ship it to Cuba, you know, for, you know, running factories or something like that? The tallow mills? Well, we have with us Alba Instant Non-Fat Dry Milk, and if you are looking for it to lose some weight, we would like to suggest that you try Alba. This is a dry fat instant milk, which is way down in calories, and it tastes like milk, which is all you can ask of milk, actually. And it's Alba. And if you can't find it, if you have trouble finding it in your store, which many people seem to have, just drop us a note here at WOR. Just say, I can't find Alba. The clown doesn't handle it. And give us his name, and we'll send the goon squad out. Boy, there'll be more guys getting hit on the head in the back there by the parking, you know, shoving around. Oh, it's terrible. You should know who's behind this outfit. I don't fool around with Alba. Frankie Knuckles Alba. Don't mess around with him. Siri Bob. It's funny. I still can't ever think of Alba without thinking of these ridiculous puns. It just bothers me. It's a twisted problem. I know all about the psychological problem, so don't tell me about it. Come on, I know. Come on, you'd be surprised. I'm way ahead of you there. Because I thought about it more, that's all. I've been with it longer than you have. I've been here, you know. I know me fairly well. I mean, probably as well as you know you, and you know how well that is. Yes. Shake hands, Shep. Meet old Shep. There you go. There, good to meet you. You got a rotten look on your face. That's right, so have you. Okay. Now we can start out. Well, Alba, we have. This chick writes and says, well, here I go, into the abyss. Some people aim for the zenith, but with me, it's always the nadir. So now, here it is. Alba alone, I'm so Alba alone. Oh, it's terrible. Listen to this one. I left my love in Alba alone. Da-dee-da-da-da. Oh, that's awful. I'm sorry. And she says, now, here it is. Leaving the musical department, I will now give you the rottenest pun you will ever get about Alba. Get ready, because I plan to kill myself after this one, so you will not hear from me after this. Thank you. Albatross, the street at Prexy's, have an Albabet soup. It is certainly superfluous to add that I have now milked Alba dry. Awful. And here's another one. Alba with you in Alba blossom time. All by myself in the morning, all by myself in the night. Oh, terrible. Boy. So if anyone can think of a good line for Alba, call me here before we go off the air. I'll be down to get you in a tank. No, I can't stop it. You know, it's funny, though, about these problems that we have concerning perception. Fine. There, that's better. It's odd. I don't know how, whether or not it's an important thing or whether it isn't. You know, I've gotten so many letters from people about the show that was aired last Friday, the one about the Indiana Dunes. And there are several things I suppose I should return to, in a sense, clarify a few issues with you. To begin with, the reason the New York Times did a big piece on for the Indiana Dunes was because they are unique. Not because they're just a nice beach or because, like many beaches, it's disappearing. They did the piece, if you listen very carefully, they did the piece because the dunes. Hey, Ed, am I fading out here or what? Am I still kicking up there? Sounds like I'm way down here. Well, they did the piece because the Indiana Dunes are unique in the United States. There are other fine beaches. There are many colorful areas in this country, but the dunes really are unique. They're dramatic, and they're extremely, extremely wild. Now, when I say wild, I mean in the wildest sense. I do not mean in the untrammeled sense. I mean wild in the sense that they are truly untamed. The list of things that live there and so on attest to that. However, one guy, for example, this guy writes to me here and he says, Jones Beach is fantastically beautiful all year long. How about taking a few practice swings before you step in the box? I did not say Jones Beach was not beautiful. I merely said that where Jones Beach stops, the Indiana Dunes starts. Now, I have experienced both of them, Jones Beach and the Indiana Dunes. They are beautiful, yes. The beaches out at Fire Island and Jones Beach. But they are just that. That's all they are. These are long, low-lying sand beaches. And they're very beautiful. There's no question about it. But they're only beautiful by comparison with a generally drab coastline that we live here in this area. Is, I think, a rather routine sea coastal area. Nothing particularly interesting geologically about it. But it is a pleasant area. There's no question about it. However, a very odd thing. I'll never forget the time when I was in Florida. This was a few years back. And I was at Palm Beach. And I traveled up to Jupiter Island. And I was in the area of Stewart. And then on down through the Miami area. But I had been at several beaches in the area. And they're very nice. There's no question about it. Palm Beach is a lovely beach. However, standing out on the pier, I was out on a long pier at twilight one night, and I got into a discussion with, there were half a dozen people hanging over the pier fishing. If you've ever been at Palm Beach, you know the big pier that goes out just outside. Well, actually, it's at Lake Worth, right off of the Lake Worth side there. It's a beautiful beach, one of the most beautiful, actually, in the whole state of Florida. And I was fresh out of the Indiana Dunes at that time. I had just left the dunes, and this was very early in the career in the Army. And I was talking to four or five, half dozen people there, and I brought up the idea. I said this, which was odd to do, I suppose, under the circumstance. I said, these are very lovely beaches, but have any of you ever seen the Indiana Dunes? I assumed that everybody knew about the Indiana Dunes because in my area, the dunes are as well known as, let us say, Jones Beach is here, actually more so, really, because it's part of the whole countryside. It is not a thing you just go to, like Jones Beach is a thing we have to travel to here. It's a good big operation to go to Jones Beach. Well, not so, the dunes. Well, I was astounded to find that none of the people on the pier there had ever even heard of the Indiana Dunes. They knew nothing about it. It's a very interesting thing to me. And I thought, well, maybe this is a local condition. And I have found, however, over the years, that I have not met more than three or four people who really know about the Indiana Dunes, who know what they mean. And when I say that they were wildly beautiful and completely unique in my experience, I mean just that. And for those of you who do have the old New York Times around, you will find that what I'm talking about is true. There was a line, for example, that, of all people, Gene Fowler wrote, and I'm not a Gene Fowler fan particularly, a reporter, but Fowler knows about the Chicago area, since he lived there for many years and worked out of there, and Fowler wrote this line, and one of the listeners sent this in to me. I hadn't been aware that he had written it, but this is on the last page of his book called Skyline. I suppose it's a book about Chicago. But this is what he says about the dunes. He says, blow, winds of yesterday. Blow across the stripped sands where the grassy dunes once dared to rise. Sing a wild song of remembrance at the place of the last and lost dunes where youth once stood looking out upon the sea. Beautiful place. And I did not in any way, shape, or form intend nor mean to, by comparison, lower the status of Fire Island or of, name it, Jones Beach, the Rockaways, it doesn't matter. All I can say is that these, I think, are fairly routine seacoastal beaches. Jones Beach is an exceptionally nice beach, there's no question about that. But I do not think that certainly, I don't think it will excite geologists. I don't think that it will excite ecologists, naturalists, the way the Indiana Dunes do and have, and probably forevermore will not. It's a sad thought. It is a sad thought, really. I don't know whether you know much about steel mills. I can tell you about a steel mill, that a steel mill has a kind of beauty, but it also has, along with this sort of beauty, I'll tell you what the steel mill is like. Have you ever come into contact with a woman, if you're a man, or a man, I would say, if you're a woman, but just, let's say, a human being who is powerful, who is ugly, and ugly so much and in so many ways and in so many subtle ways that they become strangely beautiful. Well, this is the only thing that I can say about the steel mill. The steel mill is beautiful, but only from a distance. So is that person, I can say almost without contradiction. And the beauty of a steel mill, when I say it's ironical, that a steel mill rising on the site of the sand dunes is a sort of ironical twist, because the steel mill, in a way, represents a kind of advance guard of all civilization. From the steel mills spring the turnpikes. From the steel mills spring the Nike and the Zeus rockets. From the steel mill springs all of the wells and all of the tapped and often untapped lines that make up the civilization that we are living. We don't know whether it is or not. But nevertheless, the steel mill is a kind of total, it's 180 degrees out of phase with the Indiana dunes. Now, we here in the New York City area, where you're probably thinking, well, what's all the noise about this? But I can tell you this. Now, we do here in this area, and rightfully so, we love our shorelines. There's no question about it. There's nothing I enjoy more than to go out to Jones Beach and spend a week there if I could. Anytime I spend out there, I love it. Well, how would you like it if somebody announced tomorrow morning, if it was announced on the front page of the New York Times, that, let us say, the International Cork Bottle Steel and Rail Mill had just bought the entire island, had just bought Jones Beach, the whole shebang, Fire Island, the whole business, and they were making it into a gigantic 40-inch soaking pit with cold strip mills. They were going to put in blast furnaces. They were going to put in the whole works. I mean, they were just going to make it into one gigantic industrial complex. I'll tell you, you would hear moaning, screaming, weeping, the like of which it's an impossible thing to even consider. Isn't it true? And yet, this is what's happening to the Indiana dunes. And I could tell you one other thing about the dunes that I don't think I touched on last week, and it's this. It's the only thing those people have. There is nothing else in that area. Nothing. Remember, this is in the plains. And for those of you who have driven out in Illinois and Indiana, you recognize that there's nothing but long, flat vistas of nothingness. Just great flat farms. And they're very wealthy farms, there's no question about that. But there is nowhere to go. And the lake has been slowly swallowed up in the Chicago area by the giant steel mills, by various industries of one kind or another, until it became quite obvious to most people that the only outpost, really, of a genuine beach, other than the kind that might be just, say, the Coney Island beach, which is just a workaday beach, or the one up in the Bronx. You know, these are nice little beaches, but they're certainly not places that you want to go for a whole week. You know, you plan all months to go to. Well, it became obvious to most people that this was disappearing completely. And then it was finally announced that Bethlehem Steel was going to take over the last few miles of the dunes. And that would practically kill the whole thing. There would be little patches of beach here and there, but would you like to swim yourself? Would you like to spend your weekend bracketed by a rail mill on one side, and on the other side there's a blast furnace, and they've allowed you maybe 400 or 500 yards in between, and you can swim? And this is literally what would happen out there. And so you can understand why there is some talk about it. Now, these people have no other place to go. We here in New York, there are 100 beaches we can go to if we really want to. If you want to, you could go up to Deal. You could go to Asbury Park. Sure, it's a little trip, but you could do it. Take you an hour and a half. You could go to places all up and down the Jersey Shore. And certainly there are dozens of beaches out along the island, all the way on out to Montauk Point. And if needs be, you could even go to Cape Cod. You could finally, if you had to, you could drive yourself all the way up to Maine. You know, it's only a few hours, actually, from Maine, where we are right now. Well, let me tell you that if you want to drive out of Indiana, if you live in the Chicago area and you decide you want to go to a lake, and for some reason or other you don't go to the Indiana Lake, which is the Lake Michigan area, you can't go there, you've got a long ride ahead of you. And when you get there, it's a little flat lake that is made of muddy water, and there's nothing but weeds and nothing but pop bottles when you finally get there, because they're so rare, so far and few between. You get up into the Michigan area, and that is a good drive out of Chicago. You get up into the Michigan area, and these are so overcrowded, so overloaded, the few little lakes that are in southern Michigan, that it's a very unpleasant thing to get, really to be part of. And so they have very little out there in the way of natural entertainment areas. I don't know why I'm talking about this now. I guess it's because so many people seem to be interested about it, in it, and did not know what it was about. Well, what is this? You cannot parallel it with Jones Beach. The first thing that I noticed in the mail was that most people were shocked that there should be something in the Middle West that in any way, shape, or form even compares with something around here. That's a shock. It really is to many of these people here. Because we do have an idea. And here's the additional line that I got in the mail, that if it was so great, they'd have heard about it. Let me tell you, Dad, it was great because you hadn't heard about it. That's exactly why it was. That is true. We believe in America there are four or five or six or maybe 10 big areas that we know are natural beauty areas. And anything outside of that just has to be second rate, or we'd have heard about it. They'd have promoted it, is our feeling. Well, the reason they weren't promoting it, obviously, was because they were going to turn it into an industrial complex, which is primarily what has happened with a great section of it on the southern end. But it is a magnificent thing, and if you are visiting, I'll say one thing about it. If you are going to Chicago, if you, for one reason or another, are planning a trip to Chicago in the next year, because according to the article, this was, I mean, it was a signed, sealed delivery pact that Bethlehem Steel had taken over, and that's the end of it. If you are going to Chicago in the next year, by all means do this. I think most people who get to a city completely miss the point of the city. And it's very sad. I know that most people who come to New York immediately go to all the wrong things because they just don't know any better. And cities are mysterious things unless you really know them. And I can tell you about Chicago. If you get to Chicago, there really isn't much to see in Chicago. After you've been out to the lakefront, and one thing about the lake in Chicago that you will be surprised at is the casual way that people take it. They don't make a big deal about the lake the way we make about the beach here. As a matter of fact, I suspect that summer is a New York festival, if I might turn the phrase around. I discovered that summer was a traumatic affair when I came to New York. They accept it as a matter of natural course in the Middle West. They don't make the big deal about it that we do here. And they accept the lake. It is extremely accessible. But if you do go to Chicago and you've kind of spun out the thing and you've seen it, and you want to really see the Middle West, at least you want to really see something unusual, something that you'll never see any other place in the United States, believe me, it is unique. You take the South Shore. They have a very fast interurban electric train. You get on it, and you go out. It takes you about 40 minutes on to the South Shore. The South Shore travels almost 100 miles an hour. It's like a cannonball. You get on the South Shore. Just ask anybody at the hotel, where do I catch the South Shore for the dunes? And you get on the one marked dunes, and whoom! And in about 40 minutes or 45 minutes, you will be in some of the wildest landscape that you could possibly imagine. It's completely different from anything in the United States, and is probably, in some ways, very close to what the moon would be like if it ever rained on the moon and a lake was formed and a few little pine trees began to grow. But here was the moon, and somehow the moon had developed a terrible itch. It was really itchy and just couldn't lay still. Well, that's what the dunes are. Moving around all the time, looking down on that cold, beautiful, magnificent blue water. And, you know, for 65 cents on the South Shore, you can't do much better. And, you know. Of course, there always is Tobacco Road. I guess it's still running out there. They have a few other cultural objects that you might enjoy. Read the Tribune in the morning for a while. I mean, that's the humor paper locally. And there are a few things, you know. Go out and see the White Sox. That's another. By the way, if you ever wonder what happened to Olson and Johnson, well, you go out to Comiskey Park for about 4 or 5 hours, and you'll know that they're just outclassed then.